Good evening, everyone. So last time we were looking at the impermanence of our life. So this precious life that we have attained, we know for certain will come to an end. But when that time will come, this is completely unknown, and it can happen in any moment. This life we have attained can end in any moment. And in fact, if we look at our situation, we see that our life is incredibly fragile. Whilst there are many causes, and we engage in accumulating the causes to try and sustain our life, there are far more causes that can lead to the ending of this precious life. And in fact, those very causes that we engage in to sustain our life, these too can actually lead to the end of this life. So therefore, whilst we have this opportunity, we should utilize it as well as we can. And knowing that at the time of death, a new rebirth will immediately be taken, we must ensure that we accumulate the causes that will lead to not only attaining a good rebirth in our future lives, but having good conditions so that we can continue our spiritual development in our future lives. So therefore, what we were looking at last time is an encouragement to utilize what remains of this opportunity to engage in the six perfections, practices such as generosity, ethical conduct, patience, and so forth. So tonight we're going to look at the need to engage in spiritual practices, how to engage in those spiritual practices, and so the benefits that will come from doing so, as well as the faults of not doing so. And Geshe has just read the 62nd verse. The virtuous friend in whom to place your trust has brought pure conduct to perfection, said the Lord. So follow holy beings. Many are they who relied upon the Buddhas and found peace.
Tikang Dampo, Sikpimpe, Tikang Dampo.
So let's look then at for us, the first line and a half. The virtuous friend in whom to place your trust has brought pure conduct. Okay, read that far. The first line in the Tibetan. So the meaning here is that, first of all, to look at the opportunity that we have attained. So we have come to meet the Dharma. We've come to meet a teacher who studied and understood the Dharma, and we have accumulated all the required conditions that are required in order to be able to practice the Dharma or to develop the minds of the Dharma within ourselves. So therefore, we have now achieved an opportunity to engage in spiritual practice. And whilst we have this opportunity, it's imperative that we use it well, because if we don't, we won't be creating the causes to ensure that we achieve a similar situation in future lives again. Recognizing that we have accumulated all the required conducive practices in order to engage in spiritual development and to continue with our spiritual progression, then it's imperative that we also rely on a teacher. We don't just rely on reading books and try and determine how to spiritually progress on our own, but rather to rely on someone who is spiritually developed, because such a person then can point out at the path to us, the path to us in an unmistaken manner. In other words, such a person can show us how to develop the unmistaken spiritual path within our own continuums. So here in the text we have this term pure conduct. So this then refers to a teacher whose physical behavior and verbal behavior is something that's pure, something that is unmistaken, and is always such. And the meaning of the first line and a half is that it's through relying on a teacher that we will be able to develop our virtuous mind, strengthen our virtuous mind, so that we become habituated, our mind becomes habituated to thinking in a virtuous way, and thereby our physical and verbal behavior will also always be wholesome. Recognizing the precious opportunity that we have, the fault that follows from not utilizing this opportunity well is that we don't create the causes to have continuing good opportunities like this in the future. And moreover, when our time of death comes and we take rebirth in the next life, this may well be in one of the lower realms. And once one is born in the lower realms, then it becomes impossible to engage in spiritual practice. So the meaning here, again in brief, is all of us here want to experience only happiness. None of us want to experience any problems or difficulties at all. So to bring this about, to bring about an experience of lasting, uninterrupted happiness, one has to accumulate those specific causes. And if one doesn't develop those causes, one may well continue in the current habitual patterns, where one also accumulates a lot of causes for problems and difficulties and suffering. So therefore, one needs to utilize this opportunity as well as one can. So for the reasons that have been mentioned, we need to rely on a qualified spiritual friend. So through relying on a qualified virtuous friend or spiritual friend, then one will be able to practice in an unmistaken manner, and in other words, in the correct sequence and in accordance with one's own abilities. So doing so, one will be able to take one's conduct to perfection. So what to perfection means here, or to complete, what it means in this context is, first of all, the virtuous friend is someone who's taken their pure conduct to perfection. In other words, they've developed all their virtuous qualities completely to the fullest possible extent. So this is imperative. And if one tries to practice the spiritual path on one's own without relying on a teacher, just maybe reading many books, thinking about the meaning and meditating, one will not be able to develop one's inner qualities to the level that is perfected, or develop one's inner qualities to the point where they would be said to be complete. And it's imperative that one does so, because our afflictive minds at the moment are still very coarse and easy to recognize, but very difficult to overcome. But beneath these coarse afflictions that disturb us so and destroy our peace and cause all our problems and difficulties are far subtler levels as well. And to be able to recognize these and have the ability to overcome these subtler levels of mind, one has to develop one's inner qualities to their fullest level. One has to perfect one's inner qualities, or develop one's inner qualities completely. So that is the meaning of this second line here, has brought pure conduct to perfection. So it's through bringing one's own conduct to perfection, or in particular bring one's mind to perfection, that one will be able to attain the state of Buddhahood. Without developing one's inner qualities to perfection, one will not be able to attain Buddhahood. And Buddhahood is, of course, the goal, because it's not only where one experiences the greatest bliss, and bliss that is lasting and uninterrupted, but it's where one also has the greatest ability to be of benefit to others, to be able to help others in accordance with their own individual predispositions. So this here is something that Nagarjuna taught to the king, and then Nagarjuna said in this line here, that this isn't his own idea. This is not just something he has made up. So you, O king, have faith in what I've said, or you can trust in what I'm saying, because I am just repeating to you what the Buddha himself said. And that's the meaning of the last bit of the second line. And the third line, so follow holy beings. Here Nagarjuna, the author of this root text, is encouraging the king that you now that have you have these excellent conditions to engage in spiritual practice, as well as having good health and being of intelligent mind, you should now rely on a teacher who has knowledge and experience of the unmistaken path. And through relying on him, you will achieve lasting happiness. And not only for yourself, but by you encouraging those that you have influence over, in particular his subjects, then you can encourage them to engage in virtuous activities and also to engage in spiritual practice. And in this way, you can bring lasting happiness, not only achieve it for yourself, but help others to achieve it too.
Yeah. Then the Jawala, Dinner Rabdo Mongo, Shiotop Siduda, then Jawala said the Jaw, Sanya Jumdendi, then Mundi, Sanya Jumdendi, Mabi, Yella, and Sanji, Namzi Sata, Sanji Mongojura, Chisan, the Sugar Sanji, you choose Sung Che, and the Sugar Sanji, you choose Sung Lion, yeah, Sanji, Sanji Che, Sanji, the Nigi Lamati, the Sugar Chin, and mention it. And then Mongo and Tarbata Tamjiji Mongo Toyores. And the Sanya Jumden de Yawa, Sanya Jumden de Corona Dine, Sanya Jumden de Corona Shishu, Kabia, Corona Loma, all the Meva Chen, Sanyi, Sungi, Sanyi, and Chuyi, and Chishu, and then Yaman Chen, Tarbata Tamjiji Mongo Toyores, Toyores. And then the Shuin, Sanya Jumden, Sung Shabigi, and then Chuyi. Lama Yamlinche, Lama Shangi, Yamlinche, Frontu, Yamlinche, Lama Keva, Disulia, Lama Tianjian, Sanjumi, 무슨 제 마트에 마고여로 진짜 제대로 선이 좀는지 제주 캐비 온고 근데 답변을 주진도 되네 토래 그 휴제 대슬라마 텐데니 휴제 냠내지 되네 내기 안에 아 타바 탐지 준비 고방 빠도면 그 망고 좀 토벼 토벤 망고 중요해 진짜 내니 중앙에서 딱 나눠 드리네 다들 고거 유지 겁나 아니 아마 뒤에 아니 그제 냠는 제가 있나 타바다 탐지 준비 고방 만주에 토 투구를 찍어라 와서 아니 제가 뒤에만 먹고 되니 토벼나 냠내지 토구에나 만주에 냠내지 토구를 와서 진짜 두 제목을 했어요
But then the last line in the verse here, Nagarjuna is expanding on this point and saying that all those beings who have developed themselves to the fullest extent, in other words, have attained enlightenment themselves and become Buddhas, they did so through following the advice that's just been given here. They have relied on teachers who have experience of the unmistaken path, and through relying on such teachers, they themselves became Buddhas as well. And our own teacher, Buddha Shakyamuni, he did this exactly. And moreover, through all his practice and experience, he then became a Buddha, and now he has he taught students in ancient India and presented this, and through his teachings we now have the Buddha's text, the Dharma. So innumerable beings have attained enlightenment through relying on a qualified teacher, an authentic teacher. And we as beings who have a wish to attain liberation from the suffering state of samsara, attain complete liberation where we no longer experience any problems or difficulties, no matter how slight, as well as having the wish to attain enlightenment, the state of greatest bliss and the state of greatest ability to be of benefit to others, then we too should practice like the beings of the past, those who have achieved the same results that we aspire to. So we find ourselves in this position of having really unsurpassable conditions. We have excellent conditions for developing ourselves spiritually. So we have the ability to abandon completely our afflicted minds, not just the coarse ones, but the subtle ones as well. So we have this opportunity now, this unrivaled opportunity to practice like holy beings of the past, and in fact to develop qualities within us like they developed in their progression towards enlightenment. And here we're reminded about the great benefit that comes with attainment of enlightenment, of the omniscient mind. We're reminded by the source to inspire us to strive wholeheartedly, continuously over a sustained period to attain this enlightened state. Because once a being is enlightened, not only does that being experience no problems or difficulties at all, but only lasting happiness, they have the ability to be able to lead all beings in an unmistaken way, because of their knowledge, because of their experience, And they are able to guide beings in accordance with those beings' individual predispositions, likes and dislikes, because of the omniscient consciousness. So being reminded of this now, we should be inspired, well, we hopefully are inspired to strive wholeheartedly to achieve such a state ourselves, so that we can be of greatest benefit to others. The reason why here, as well as very often in the Dharma, the fault of not doing something and the benefits of doing something is so often presented, is so as to encourage us to engage in virtuous practices, to turn away from harmful practices. Because it's only through clearly recognizing the faults of certain behavior, the benefits of the opposing behavior, that one will be encouraged to engage in the mental development, so as to abandon completely all negative habits and develop completely all virtuous habits. So that's why here, as well as quite often, there's a presentation on qualities, on benefits, as well as faults. And this is so as to give us the knowledge to give us the knowledge to encourage us, to be encouraged to engage in virtue and to turn away from non-virtue. This approach that we come across so often in the text is not something unique to the Buddha Dharma, but is found in the world as well. So if you think back to when we were younger and we were trying to decide what career to engage in, and we're deciding, so if should I maybe go to university and study this, or should I study that? Then the process we were going through, we're thinking about the benefits of going in one direction and the faults of not going in a particular direction. Or if we're thinking of maybe doing something different, again, the conversations we would have been having would have been about the benefits of doing something and the faults of doing something different or doing nothing at all. So this is how it works in the world, and it's certainly how it works in the presentation of the Buddha Dharma. Because if we clearly come to recognize the benefits or the good qualities that come from developing virtuous minds within us, and the faults that will come from remaining under the influence of our afflicted minds, then we'll want to make the required change. We'll want to put in the effort that is required over a lengthy period. We will want to do this despite the hardships and difficulties that come with mental training, with mental development. So this works in the world at large, as well as certainly within the spiritual context. So the more knowledge we have, and if we come to see the benefits clearly and the faults clearly, the result is we'll put in much more effort and over the required length of time.
And this
way of approaching things isn't unique to the world of education. It certainly happens in business and many fields in life. So for example, in business, the business person will have a goal to make a profit, and then they will devise a technique to make this profit. And they'll think, so if I was to do this, what benefits would come? What problems would I experience? What faults may come if I embark on this venture? So business thinks in this way too. And certainly in other fields, such as in engineering or design in any field, maybe there'll be a particular a problem that someone wants to design something to overcome. Then they will look at the benefits of a particular plan, the faults of that same plan, and maybe compare various plans to see which is the best to achieve their goal, which may be to overcome a fault or to design something completely new and unseen. So this is something, this way of thinking, of coming to understand benefits and faults, so as to encourage one to engage in an unmistaken direction. This is something that is seen in many different contexts. So in our context here, then, in the spiritual context, we talk about the benefits of achieving Buddhahood, of the state of omniscience, of developing oneself so that one arises as a Buddha. And then, having seen the great benefits that come from achieving such a state, then the path is presented, the technique for achieving that. Or then there's also a presentation on how to achieve complete liberation, liberation from cyclic existence, liberation from the sufferings of samsara. Then having seen all the benefits that come with achieving such a goal, then the path is presented how to develop oneself mentally to achieve such a state. Well, thirdly, the benefits of attaining further good rebirths are clearly presented. Now, having seen the benefits, then there's of course the interest in how to achieve another good rebirth. So that path, the path then is presented. So this is how it works in the context of the Buddha Dharma, as well as in many contexts within the world as well. And a further way that our situation here is the same as in the world is that we now find ourselves to be in good health, and this is at the best time to engage in studies, because generally in the world education is usually done when people are younger, and there are many reasons for this, but one of the benefits of engaging in intensive studies when one is young is that one is physically quite capable. So we're not in our youth anymore, but certainly we can say in general our situation that we have it now is not going to be how it will be in some years to come. So therefore we should utilize whatever state of health we have now, hopefully it's good, and utilize this as well as we possibly can. And also in the world, generally, young people, children and young people engage in full-time education. And another benefit of doing this when you're young is that they are not having to work full-time, so they have more time on their hands. Now, most of you don't have that much time on your hands, so this is an obstacle. But nevertheless, you do have some time. So here, this, you're encouraged to utilize the time you have to study and to meditate, to come to develop oneself internally.
Control. 이제 저도
Happiness, feelings of happiness or experiences of happiness, this can be divided into two, physical and mental. So we can have physical feelings of happiness and suffering and mental feelings of happiness and suffering. So physical feelings of suffering would be, for example, if one is cold, or if one is hungry, or if one is ill. So these are primarily physical. And the way to eliminate these, well, these we know well. These are eliminated in dependence on others, either through utilizing the money we've made through our work, and we can maybe buy warmer clothing or buy some food, go and visit the doctor, or if we are impoverished, then we can rely on the kindness of others to give us food, or maybe if we're young and we're relying on our parents, they would give us food. So this kind of these physical difficulties can generally be solved through others, either through paying for something or through the kindness of others. Then mental problems, though, this is something, though, that others cannot solve for us, cannot eliminate for us. So our afflictive minds, our destructive emotions, for example, anger or pride or attachment. We can't go to a doctor and they eliminate these for us. We can't go to our friends and they eliminate this for us. This is something we need to do ourselves. We need to develop the antidote to these minds, the contrary minds. So we need to develop the contrary mind to anger so that anger no longer arises. Or if it does, it doesn't dominate. So we need to develop these contrary minds, these antidotes ourselves. This is only something that we ourselves can do. Furthermore, the physical suffering that we experience, this doesn't have an impact on our future lives. So if we're hungry and we're cold in this life, then in our next life, that's not going to continue to our next life. However, if we remain dominated by our afflicted minds, that will continue on our mental continuum into our next life. So that is a second difference between physical suffering and mental suffering. So to overcome our physical suffering, our mental suffering, we need to develop our mind. We need to be able to change our way of thinking. So right now we will have negative habitual ways of thinking. So maybe we become enraged in certain circumstances, or desirous in certain circumstances, or quite proud. So this way of thinking, this habitual way of thinking, this we need to change, and rather develop the contrary mind, so that these minds start to arise first through effort and then spontaneously. So to do this is not something that we can rely on buying a pill or going to see someone. Rather, this is work we need to do ourselves. But to be able to do this ourselves, we need guidance. We need training from someone who is experienced, who has knowledge and experience, someone who has done it themselves. So this here is why we need to rely on a teacher. Because through relying on a teacher who has developed their own pure conduct to perfection, then they are able to train us in an unmistaken way, and thereby we have the tools required to develop our own minds and progress towards the attainment of liberation from suffering or Buddhahood itself. When relying on a teacher, then one comes to understand, come to understand the suffering that we are experiencing and what causes us to experience suffering. So we need to come to recognize what is causing us all the problems and the difficulties that we experience in our lives. And we have a natural wish not to experience any suffering or problems or difficulties at all. So when we come to recognize clearly, so in a way that this recognition arises within us in a powerful manner, we will naturally turn away from whatever is causing us our problems and difficulties. And then accompanying this, through relying on a teacher, we will understand what is the need to accumulate virtue and what is meant by the accumulation of virtue. In other words, we come to understand how to turn our mind in the direction of virtue. And the starting point of being able to do that is having a virtuous motivation. The motivation is what differentiates an action as to whether it's going in the direction of virtue or not. So the motivation is crucial. And this is, and a motivation, of course, is a mind. So therefore, one needs to understand what is a virtuous motivation and how to develop it. First of all, one needs to come to a very clear understanding about the suffering that pervades samsara. So in other words, our entire experience within cyclic existence is pervaded by suffering. So this is something that we need to understand very clearly, because we are aware of the course of problems that we have experienced in this life, we are experiencing now, and we will experience in the future. But we need to understand the far subtler levels of suffering, and that they pervade samsara, that as long as our minds remain trapped within the samsaric experience, we will continue to be pervaded by suffering throughout this life and future lives. So we have our own experience of suffering. We see the suffering of others on a coarse level, either directly or say through the television news, where we see people suffering from war, we see people suffering from hunger and impoverishment, and people experiencing illness. And some of this we too will have experience of. But these are the coarser levels, and these we have some understanding of, but we need to come to understand the subtler levels too, and how they pervade samsaric existence from lifetime to lifetime. So this is the first thing that we need to come to understand, because understanding this clearly will give rise to a powerful wish to be free of this situation, to be liberated from this situation, because none of us wishes to have problems or difficulties at all. So to give rise to a strong wish to be liberated from cyclic existence, so that this wish can arise within oneself in a powerful enough extent that it serves to change one's behavior, and it serves to change one's behavior, firstly, one has to think about suffering a lot. One needs to think about how the reality of cyclic existence. Think about the reality of the situation of humans. Think about the reality of the situation of beings born elsewhere in samsara. So, for example, we can think about fish. So fish, on one hand, they seem to swim about quite freely in the water, and they can be quite beautiful, so it looks quite nice, but When you think just a little bit more about their situation, these days with climate change, their environment that really pervades them, it's becoming quickly dirtier and dirtier. And also due to climate change, in certain environments, the lakes and the rivers are drying up, and those fish caught in that situation, they don't have the ability to do anything about it. But their ability to live is being rapidly diminished. And also, of course, all fish experience the great fear of continuously being under danger of being caught by other fish and killed and eaten alive. So this kind of understanding is a recognition or the reality of just that one type of sentient being. But throughout samsara, all sentient beings are continuously experiencing suffering of various magnitudes. So this is something that we need to think about and think about on the subtler levels, because this will lead to a strong wish to be free of the situation. We need to come to an understanding of what it means to be trapped within cyclic existence, and without this understanding, it will be very difficult for the wish to arise in a powerful way to be freed of this situation. So to come to this conclusion, to come to this position where one has gives rise to a strong wish to be liberated from suffering, one needs to meditate on suffering, and one also needs to meditate on impermanence. These are the two key topics. And when we talk about impermanence, here we are particularly referring not to the coarse impermanence that we can experience, but the impermanence that is momentary change or subtle impermanence, that things change moment by moment by moment, that nothing has any lasting value at all. So these are the first two key topics that one needs to meditate on. Impermanence, in particular the momentary change or subtle impermanence, as well as the suffering, and the suffering of cyclic existence as a whole. And again, not just on the coarse level, but the subtler level. And these are the two meditations required to give rise to a genuine wish to be freed from this, as from cyclic existence. Once one has meditated effectively on impermanence and suffering and given rise to this genuine wish to be freed from this suffering state of samsara, then one is suitable, one is ready to actually generate the mind of bodhicitta. So there is this sequence that first one generates the wish to be liberated from cyclic existence, and then one can generate the wish to attain Buddhahood. So here, so if one goes to the meditation, gives rise to this wish to be freed from suffering and be freed from all the suffering states that pervade samsara and be liberated from this. So this is where you give rise to the wish for liberation for oneself. And at this point, the practitioner can make a decision that they are going to strive for their own individual liberation from cyclic existence, and then they will engage in following the path of the Tathagata. But at this same point, an individual practitioner may make a different decision. They have seen that how suffering pervades cyclic existence, and how there is not a moment of true peace to be experienced anywhere within cyclic existence. So they therefore have given rise to this wish to be free from the state that is pervaded by suffering, but then they take this understanding and they apply it to others. Because they know that each and every other sentient being trapped within cyclic existence is suffering in exactly the same way. Their experience is pervaded by suffering, and they are trapped in this position. So at this point, the practitioner would naturally give rise to minds of love, such as love and compassion, but they have the choice then to develop those further and develop them to the point where they generate the mind of enlightenment or generate bodhicitta. And they give rise to the wish that it's unsuitable for them as a practitioner to just strive for their own happiness but leave all the other kind mother sentient beings behind. Rather, they need to strive for enlightenment for the sake of others, and thereby become the most skillful guide for others. And at this point then, they're ready to give rise to actual bodhicitta within themselves. So it's at the point of giving rise to the wish for liberation that one can call a partition or a border between the two vehicles, that of the Tathagatan path and that of the Mahayana path. So what differentiates practitioners at this partition who have decided to go in one or the other direction is their motivation. It's exactly this, their motivation. So they both have a strong and unwavering determination to achieve a particular goal. But the one who has decided to follow the Tathagatan path and strive to achieve their own individual liberation from cyclic existence, they have a strong and powerful determination to achieve that goal. The other type of practitioner, that has decided to achieve Buddhahood for the sake of others, they have made also a strong and stable commitment, but for a different goal, the goal of achieving Buddhahood for the sake of others. So it's their motivation that differentiates these two types of practitioners.
Tarba
So just to reiterate, what differentiates these two practitioners is their motivation. Because what are the practitioners, what are the practices that these two practitioners are going to need to engage in? So on the one hand, you have the one who is committed to achieving liberation from suffering, to achieve a state of lasting peace. Then on the other hand, you have a practitioner who is committed to achieve Buddhahood for the sake of others. So there you have these two practitioners, one of the Theravadan path, one of the Mahayana path. And now what are their practices that they are going to engage in? They both will engage in the practice of generosity. They both will engage in the practices of ethical conduct. They both will engage in the practices of patience, joyous perseverance, concentration, and wisdom. So they're actually engaging in the same practices even after they have decided or they've set themselves on a particular goal. So what differentiates them is not their practices, but it's their motivation. And the what makes this motivation of the Bodhisattva stand out so is that they have generated minds of love and compassion that have led on to the cultivation of bodhicitta itself and thereby given rise to the wish to achieve enlightenment. That aspect of the motivation is something that just the Bodhisattva accumulates, that the Bodhisattva develops. The practitioner of the Theravadan path does not develop that aspect of the motivation. So from this explanation, it should sound, and it should probably will sound, like there's actually not much difference between these two types of practitioners. They have differing goals and therefore differing motivation, but their practices are the same. So therefore it's going to sound like there's not too much difference between them.
So to clarify
or to make clear the difference that does exist between these two practitioners engaging in the same kinds of practices is, let's take it as an analogy. If a child and an adult, they come to a place where there's an abundance of gold and diamonds scattered everywhere, and they are both told you can take away as much as you want. So they both are engaging in the same activity of gathering together gold nuggets and diamonds, and they're gathering as much as they can, and they're carrying it away to utilize as they wish. Now they're engaging in the same activity, but they clearly it's going to be quite a different result. The adult will know how to and have the ability to gather a lot more gold, far many more gold nuggets and diamonds, and thereby will be able to achieve so much more with this. So this analogy then can be likened to the position that these two practitioners find themselves in. Both of them will be engaging in practices of, say, generosity or ethical conduct, so they're engaging in the same practice. But the power of their practice is completely different. The power of their practice is vastly different. So we've now spoken about how the these two different kinds of practitioners, what differentiates them is not their practices, but their motivating intention. So we've looked at that now, so let's now have a look at what these practices are in brief. Let's look at, in brief, what these practices are that they engage in. So practitioners of both types, those of the Theravada or the Mahayana type, they will engage in these practices. So firstly, the practice of generosity. So the practice of generosity is the mind that wants to give. So all these practices are mental paths, are minds that one develops. And it's through developing these virtuous minds that one overcomes their contrary minds, their harmful minds. And it's these harmful minds, or these afflictive minds, these destructive emotions, these are the minds that cause us all our problems and suffering, and when acted upon, we cause problems for others too. So the way to overcome these afflictive minds that cause us and others such harm is through developing virtuous minds, their contrary minds, their opposite minds. So minds such as miserliness, for example, this leads to one engaging in a variety of activities so as to have more and more and to keep what one has and to have more and more. And this then can easily lead us to engaging in activities that bring harm to others. So this way, this harmful mind of miserliness brings harm to ourselves and to others. And to overcome this, we need to develop the contrary mind, the mind of generosity. So the mind of generosity is the mind that wants to give. So the more we develop this virtuous mind, then a non-virtuous mind will weaken. So as the virtuous mind grows in strength, the corresponding non-virtuous mind will naturally weaken. So it's through doing this then, we weaken our destructive emotion of miserliness, and it's through acting under the influence of miserliness that we create causes to remain trapped in samsara. Now, through generating or developing the contrary mind of generosity and acting under that influence, we create the causes to be liberated from samsara or to attain enlightenment in accordance with our motivation. And similarly, with the mind of ethical conduct. So if we lack a mind of ethical conduct, then we will engage in activities that bring harm to ourselves and others. If we have a mind of ethical conduct, then we will not bring harm to others. It will serve to restrain us, because the practice of ethical conduct is developing a mind of restraint. So the mind of ethical conduct is a mind of restraint, and it serves to restrain our physical activities, our verbal activities, and even our mental activities, and ensure that we remain in a virtuous, in a wholesome direction, and not going in a non-virtuous direction. And so just like with generosity and with the following minds as well, the more we develop this virtuous mind of ethical conduct, the weaker will be the corresponding destructive emotions, such as harmful intent. And the weaker harmful intent comes, the less likely we are to think in that way and thereby create negative karma, or speak in that way, speak under its influence, or act physically under its influence and create negative karma, create the causes to remain trapped in samsara. But the stronger we develop this mind of restraint, this mind of ethical conduct, the greater impact it will have on our way of thinking, our way of physically acting and speaking. And thereby we'll create more and more causes to attain liberation from suffering or full and complete enlightenment. And then this is the same with the mind of patience. So patience is a mind that stays calm and spacious in the face of conflict. It's not a mind that makes one just stay quiet in the face of difficulties, but it's rather a mind that remains calm and spacious when facing adversity. So at the moment, if we don't have a well-developed mind of patience, then the afflictive mind of anger will easily arise. And when that arises, it's creating the causes for us to remain trapped in samsara. And when we act upon it, physically or verbally, we bring harm to others and we create further causes to remain trapped in samsara. But the mind of patience, when we deliver this, seeing the faults of anger, seeing the faults of acting under the control of anger, we then develop this mind of patience. And then, no matter what problems and difficulties we encounter, our mind stays clear and spacious, and we are not only do we not respond harmfully, but we are able to respond skillfully and beneficially. And thereby, instead of creating the causes to remain trapped in samsara, we create the causes to be liberated from suffering. And then the fifth mind, the fourth mind is that of concentration. So this is needed because by developing concentration, we overcome the mind of distraction. So that a distracted mind is a mind that is not aware of our mental activity, and therefore we can easily engage in many faults. So therefore one requires concentration. And the sixth mind is that of wisdom. So wisdom is a mind that investigates reality. It's an analytical mind, an investigating mind. And so through investigating a reality, we come to a greater understanding of reality, in particular of selflessness or emptiness. And as we come to develop the wisdom understanding emptiness, so too do we develop our understanding of dependent arising. And as this mind of wisdom, this crucial mind of wisdom, grows and strengthens within us, then, like with the others, the opposite minds, they weaken. But with wisdom, all the afflictive minds are included as opposite to wisdom. So as our wisdom strengthens, all our destructive emotions, they weaken, and our virtuous minds grow and strengthen.
ほら、だってね、さ、なんか、ギリギリ。だ、ラブチェティ、モルルギリ、あの、ディネケ、ケボルソンは、カルソンはですね、だ、そうすると、ギリギリ、サンワ、ディン、トゥニエ、ディン、ヤホイヨバ、ボガビビ、カブラ、あの、チケ、ギシュトゥブレス。チザ、サンジェコマ、トゥビチェド、ね、ギャバ、ナマティチェネ、カソンです。ギシュトゥブレソンは。 디네 다 산지고고 로디
지나
Julia Kali Havacher, Longer, Tinason, Nikon, yet in the yard as a queen, queen, she said, yeah.
So just to summarize what we looked at tonight, so the author of our text, Nagarjuna, he's given further advice, the 62nd verse of advice to the king. And here he's reminded the king about the excellent conditions that he has achieved for developing the himself spiritually. And not only to develop, can he develop himself spiritually, but he can actually strive for the state of full and complete enlightenment. And to do so, he needs to rely on a qualified spiritual teacher. So this advice that was that's given here in this verse, it doesn't just apply to this king in ancient India, but equally applies to all of us. And to give rise to a sincere wish to utilize all our mental energy to strive for a state freed of suffering, then the starting point is to meditate on impermanence, in particular that of subtle impermanence, of momentary change, as well as to look at the reality of the state of samsaric existence, to look at how suffering pervades samsara. So that is the starting point for us to give rise to a powerful wish to be freed of this, because if without seeing the reality of our situation, we won't give rise to a powerful mind, a mind that changes our way of thinking, and thereby will not engage wholeheartedly in our spiritual development. And once one has given rise to this wish to be free of cyclic existence, then one has the opportunity to take that understanding that one has developed about one's own experience within samsara and relate that to each and every other sentient being. And each and every other sentient being is suffering in exactly the same way as we are, in a situation pervaded by suffering. And at that point, seeing how all beings are suffering in the same way as we are, and knowing how each and every single one of them wants to be liberated, wants to be freed from the state, even though they haven't yet recognized their current situation, then compassion arises within us for their suffering situation. Love arises within us, wishing for them to be freed of the situation. And in those two minds of love and compassion, we intentionally cultivate them, develop them further in our meditation, until we give rise to the mind that takes responsibility for the welfare, for the happiness of all other sentient beings. And it's at that point we give rise to the clear commitment to achieve Buddhahood for the sake of others. And in this way, bodhicitta arises following the wish to attain liberation from suffering. Then, in our meditation, we develop the minds of generosity, ethical conduct, etc. And then these minds we should take with us into all our activities throughout the day. So whatever activities we engage in our busy lives, these should be pervaded by these six perfections. In this way, our practice doesn't just remain something mental that we do on the cushion, but everything that we do should be directed, motivated by these six perfections. And if we summarize these six perfections down to just two, we could say it is a commitment not to harm others at all through our way of speaking, our physical activities, or even having a negative trains of thought. And moreover, to keep our mind virtuous, to keep our mind wholesome, and whenever we communicate with others, to do so in a beneficial way. When we physically interact, to do so in a beneficial way. And to help others as much as we can, whenever we can. So this is a summary of what we've looked at tonight. And tomorrow we'll continue with the next verse and the next two verses. Then they cover the state of freedom that we have now, that would be lost if we were to fall into the lower realms in a future rebirth. So that's what we'll start with tomorrow morning. We are a little bit late now, but if you have questions, please feel free to ask. If you need to go, please feel free to leave. Brian.
There are universal enlightened tantric spirit teachings, and I've heard that ordinary tantric spiritual teachings. What's the difference between the two?
Between ordinary tantric teachings and?
I'm not hearing it clearly, sorry. I heard there are universal enlightened tantric spiritual teachings and there are ordinary tantric spiritual teachings. What's the difference?
Okay, so what is the difference between ordinary tantric teachings and
ordinary
enlightened tantric teachings? Okay. Dyna gwn mac rigni yore nge gosong mac rigni yore nge gosong chig namgyn nang zin re chig yedi inti ge dokla dyn eti me chig yon gwni yome dyna chig namgyn nang zin re chig jansup gi rig de re So, what you're talking, referring to, I've never heard of, so I can't use this particular terminology. So, I asked Genla as best as I could, and he said, look, there are four types of tantra, and then he mentioned the four types, the action, performance, yoga, and highest yoga. But this division into two, I don't know what these terms are. I haven't heard of them. Okay, thank you. Yes, there at the back.
Yes. In the case where you have teachers who lay people or take wives and things like this, and they have a very different conduct, they have a very loose ethical standards. They might have a lot of drinking, smoking, party women, and then if you take them as your lama, and then you then follow their conduct, you're necessarily creating bad karma.
Okay.
If you fall into traps and things like that.
So if you have you take someone as a teacher who's not ordained and who doesn't has loose ethical conduct in terms of sexual activity, drinking, smoking, partying, this kind of thing, then if you follow their example, are you creating negative karma?
Yes.
Yeah? Yeah? Okay. Then he Michik Lama Kelant Jena, then Lama De Kong Mika Re, then Yini Kong Chupa Nyempa Tengiore. Araktung tama ten kiemenda namdu de la sokpa. Dene lama de kelen tene kungi chöpa dan drapo tena kase lama dan chupa jeka res. Dene dikpa sage rebe.
Na dirwa. Na lami ji chöpa kare jeba maashin su chugi ne jeba inuta po enjimi ji jeba kwa suyo mare. Sina lami ji di chigi sunandu di jeba ina mano zulia 변형한 이 차가 차비 온게 집에 있는 집어 살고 봐도 차발이고 지난 상에 주면 이게 가르송을 쓰네 지금 남이 최대한 준비기 수술 남에 있네야 남아지 마셔야 아니 기회 초소 아니 최대한 준비하지 가나면 디냐면 제고 이제 지난 최대한 마준비하지 최대한 마준비하지 시외나 디냐면 제고가 말했어. 那些南美宋的是你的，你结婚时候买的时候，就在那里当中就，南美的那几个就是啊，那几个男的都是这个嘛的，这个嘛，那是那俺们这个长途买的，他妈天，那些钱买的，那所以说女的女的嘛的，那这些长途这边，几顿这些吃饭钱，那吃饭第一件的吃毛毛东西，第二件，那些两个拿出现在那边的家伙，我理解了吧？那在的，那些呢，地方，地方也是。
So, firstly, one doesn't have to do everything that one's teacher does. There's no compulsion to do so. And then secondly, the second point to make is that whatever one does through attachment creates negativities. So those are the first two key things to be aware of. Then the Buddha himself said that the teacher's teachings need to be in accordance with virtue. not in accordance with unwholesome conduct. And so whether any teacher's teachings are in accordance with virtue or not, this is something that the student needs to check and decide for themselves. But in terms of their own behavior, there's certainly no compulsion to follow the example set by a teacher. And we can see even from a regular understanding that drinking and smoking causes harm to oneself. So even setting aside the karmic results that come, drinking and smoking causes harm to oneself physically. So there is no compulsion to act in the same way as one's teacher does. Rather, you just look at his teachings, use your own intelligence, and being aware, following the mind of attachment, leads to the development of negative karma. Okay. Yes, one at the back.
Just going back to the very verse, the teaching, when you rely on someone spiritual. So, I've been wondering, I still haven't got my answer. Do you have to have one teacher, or can you have many? And if they don't want you, or if they give up on you, will they tell you?
So should you have one teacher or should you have more than one?
Or can
you have one teacher? Should you have one teacher or can you have more than one? And if they give up on you, would they tell you so?
Don't want
to be your teacher? Or don't want to be a teacher after having accepted you or in the first place?
Both.
Yeah, okay.
And do you have to ask them?
And you have to ask them. Okay, good. Okay. Then Tawe lama ki kola o gere sini ki kola adria dramida yare dene gere sini chik gogire yama ya chik dang chikle mangwa yona dugi duge di chikche de gangla lama dene kona ne chöke hakusong yini mi chik kelen ki lama kelen jena kelen ma te kongla lama la rekul chekere pena kerenge lama yina ye dampo keren la rekul che ke de pes di ni che deni lama lobchukla kelen mate ki to pe yina lobchukla katuk lapke de be sum che deni tama lame ke chukla kelen che chapne ma hompa ke chuk de pi ki to pe yina ke chukla lapke de be
Namja
Disimpa, lamala katuk rekul jena, dene ini lama dopa mena, lama kena katuk lap maret lap yera ve.
Dadi lama soso rana disu dadi rota lama cik jena kashi ke o dadi ko korong rangi dadi cik yenden te tu yu mena na dene ke lama cik tu dama do lama soso rana ke sam ta je dene kashi ne dadi ni mu bare cikana shi dadi cik la do ko re kashi ne dadi cik de sa che. カラスの人、断たそうすぎちゃうまるのだけに地味やせやで、地まるわそう。え、だからもうロマチ味やせやな。あの地、地やこちゃな、地地でさ、でね、地まるわ。こう、ね、ラマ地、ロマ地、ね、ロマ地銀さんで、サムの名前、ラマ金さんでちゃら、ロマでや、地け、こ、コロンや、地ラジャジャな、地でわ。で、まにな、何コロン地、まにな、まにで、こちへすかよまるわ。いいわ。あ、で、たまんのにあまそう。
ただまでぎゅうちゃんやめんでねちょうでねちょうでねちぎりしぎるまだ。しね、ただまでぎゅうたころんげとちょうでなめしばなかなじまとばいな、こちもとばいな。なめだね、どまじめきょろはぴきんせでよまだ。みつ、ぱじゅうすんどほまれ。でね、でねんだ、あね、こ、からせね、だ、そすぎんやめんじまどんのそすぎょんわちちゃぎまと。なめにげ、すんどほまれ。
Okay, so four questions. So first of all, should one have one teacher, or is it okay to have more than one? So here it's so Gena says, if the teacher knows the whole path, you don't need more than one. You can just rely on that one teacher. If he or she doesn't know the whole path, then you definitely need more than one. Just like at school or university, one needs different teachers to study different things. If that is the case, then you need different teachers. But if the one teacher knows the whole path, then you only need to rely on one teacher. That being said, should you wish to rely on more than one, that's entirely up to you. There's no fault in having more than one teacher either. Okay. Then the second question, do you need to request directly to a teacher to be taken as their student? And here Geshe says no. So on a practical level, there may well not be the opportunity. You're receiving teachings from someone, but you don't have the opportunity to meet with them privately, then you don't have that opportunity. But even though that it's, whether it is or isn't practically possible, it's still not necessary. For someone to be your teacher, you generate that mind, that commitment from your side, you are my teacher. And that's sufficient. That's sufficient. If one were to have that discussion, that's fine with the teacher, but it's not required. Then that's second. Then thirdly, if the teacher didn't want to accept you, would they say so directly? So, as again I said, well, I suppose so. This would depend on their personality, but what they may well do is if, for whatever reason, they feel that they aren't best suited to guide you, they may well send you, direct you towards someone else and suggest you maybe go to that teacher or whatever. But this is how they respond is dependent on their individual personality. And then the last question, the fourth question, is having taken you as a student, would they abandon you? Would they turn you away? And this is unlikely. Again, I was a bit surprised by that this even being possible. And so he said, look, what the teacher does is teach you the path, teach you how to develop these minds within yourself. And if you as a student follow this advice, or not, this is up to you. If you follow it, there's great benefit that will come. If you don't follow it, it's only your loss, nothing to do with the teacher. So there's no reason for the teacher to discard you as a student if you are not following their advice. So, yeah, but, is that clear for all four? Oh, good, good.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry it got a little late. Then see you tomorrow.
Oh, it's,